Welcome to Homeground. I'm Brian Kahn. Polls show most Americans believe that climate is changing and that human-generated carbon is part of the problem. And governments around the world are taking action to reduce emissions. But in the United States, there's a partisan divide. Republican office holders tend to say either that the climate is not changing or that it's not clear that humans are causing the change. Their Democratic counterparts tend to disagree. With political paralysis in Congress, the Environmental Protection Agency has issued rules requiring states to develop their own plans to reduce carbon emissions from power generation. Is there potential for common ground? Bob Inglis has some thoughts. He's a former Republican congressman from South Carolina who currently directs the Energy and Enterprise Institute at George Mason University. Bob, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Great to be with you, Brian. Thank you.
Welcome to Montana.
Well, thanks. It's my first time here, and it's really a fabulous place.
What makes you say it's fabulous?
Well, I get to spend some time in Yellowstone.
That's a good start.
Yes, and saw some amazing critters and incredible scenery.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Bluffton, South Carolina, which is on the coast in South Carolina. And so I'm the fourth of five children, and my dad was an industrial engineer. He's 92 years old and still lives in the same house that I grew up in Bluffton, South Carolina.
That must be great.
Yeah, we lost my mom two years ago now, and he's soldiering on at 92.
What led to your interest in politics?
I was very interested in politics in high school and into college, and then went to law school and found out that it was too ego-driven, so I sort of stepped away from politics and then came back after a time of figuring out that it was, as I say, too much ego. And so it was moving back to South Carolina in 1986 from a two-year time in Savannah, Georgia, practicing law that gave me the opportunity to think more deeply about getting into politics.
Just for clarity, when did you graduate law school?
1984.
84, okay. You became aware or under the perception that there was too much ego in politics. That just, I assume, didn't come from a cloud. Was there some experience that you had?
Yeah, really surrounded by some people that took what was called the Washington option at the University of Virginia Law School. Back then, UVA was a state school and had residency requirements. And so what people would do is work for the House or the Senate from their home state, but live on the Virginia side of the border and then apply to law school. And so they ended up at the University of Virginia Law School. There are a lot of them. And many of them had thought through, particularly in a Christian fellowship group I was part of, had thought through the application of truth to public policy. And for me, I just had to admit that I hadn't done that. I just thought it'd be a kick to be involved in politics and to read my name in the paper. So realizing that wasn't a good motivation, I sort of swore off politics for a while.
All right, so it was self-examination we're talking about.
Yeah.
You mentioned a Christian group. Are you a man of serious faith from your perspective?
It's the most important relationship of my life, yes. So I grew up in the Episcopal Church. I spent a long time in the Presbyterian Church of America, and then came back now to the Episcopal Church.
Back to politics. Politics is often about political philosophy. How would you describe yours?
I believe that the philosophy that drives me is one of free enterprise, individual accountability, and also caring for community. I had a vision statement that I came up with when I was serving in Congress the first time and running for the Senate. The vision statement was this: a prosperous, growing land in which a free people engaged in free enterprise have the opportunity in fairness to secure for themselves the blessings of the American dream, dream being the God-given desire to create, to contribute, and to care.
I've interviewed a lot of politicians. I've never had anybody have a statement that dimensional and definitive, whether one agrees or disagrees, carefully chosen words. Why did you do it?
I was, inspired by people like Roger Milliken and companies that have vision statements. And so along the way, He and others challenged me to develop a vision statement, and said that that's how they won the Deming Award. And so I decided if I'm running for the Senate, I better have a vision statement myself. And so that's where it came from. And it is sort of amazing that I remember it, since that was 1998.
Yeah, that's a fair piece of time. In summary, lay out your political career. You said you were running for the Senate from Congress. When did you get elected to Congress?
I was first elected, having never run for office before, in 1992. And then I served 6 years, said I'd limit myself to 6 years in office. Ran for the Senate in 1998, unsuccessfully challenging Senator Hollings. And then I was out doing commercial real estate law for 6 years. Ran again in 2004, and served an additional 6 years. Until they were having a tea party in the 4th District of South Carolina, and I got specifically uninvited to the tea party.
In 2010.
The June primary, Republican primary in June of 2010.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Bob Inglis, the director of the Energy and Enterprise Institute at George Mason University. Now, you had, as a younger person, felt ego in politics in your own self. How'd you find it in Congress? What kind of people?
I found people mostly interested in serving and doing good things, many quite afraid of the people they represent.
Now, that's an astonishing statement, afraid of the people they represent. What do you mean?
You know, we all complain about Congress. They say we say they don't listen to us, you know, they don't pay attention to us. Actually, they pay very close attention, and they're frightened of us. They're really sort of afraid of us because they think that we can't operate at full citizenship level, that we have to be placated, that we have to be carefully handled, rather than be told the honest, straight-out, unvarnished truth about what our circumstances are.
That's very interesting. Someone might look at that sort of conduct of playing to the audience's preconceptions and say it's manipulative as opposed to based, fear-based, that it's manipulative-based. What would you say to that?
Could be a little bit of both, couldn't it? I mean, in other words, yeah, they're trying to manipulate in order to stay alive politically.
Correct.
But the fear is that they're gonna die politically.
All right.
You know, and so everybody in Congress is willing to lose over something. It's just for some people, the bandwidth of what they're willing to lose over is very small. Like if you offend their mother and their grandmother and maybe their wife all at the same time, they'd fight you on that and they'd actually be willing to lose on that point. But others have a broader bandwidth of issues, places they're willing to lead, even if it may get them in trouble. But, you know, I'm quite convinced that it's one thing to lose an election. It's quite another to lose your soul. So it's better to lose the election than to lose your soul.
Let me just say before we start talking about climate change and where you stand and what your thoughts are, the word that does not come to mind listening to you is principled leadership. Would you agree that that's a serious problem in our Congress, irrespective of party, just the way you described a fear-based style of governance?
Yeah, we need two things. One, we need principled leaders, people that are willing to tell us the straight facts. And then we need the willingness of the people to rise to full citizenship.
Meaning
that be willing to be told the truth, be willing to hear it, and hear the hard things so that we don't just, you know, it doesn't help to have a political leader who just tells us that everything's going to be okay, because in fact, if it's not going to be okay, if something needs to change, they really need to tell us that. And then we need to be willing to hear it rather than to, upon hearing it from them, reject them, say, well, we're not willing to hear that anymore. We want to choose this other person who just tells us that we're okay and these other people are bad.
All right, now, one final question about that before we get to climate change, because what you're saying raises questions in my mind. Mm-hmm. You were 12 years in the United States Congress. What's your sense for what the people are willing to hear? Are the American people willing to step up and be full citizens as you just described?
The place where I think we're least willing to hear the truth is about budget matters. We just, basically what we what we say to our members of Congress and senators is, you go up there and balance a budget, but don't touch my Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid for my Down syndrome niece, or anything else that's special to me.
Yes.
And so they hear us very well. They say, I got it. You want me to go up there and talk and do nothing. Pretty good at that in Washington. So they comply with our orders. If we rather told them, no, we want you to tell us what can be fixed about Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, I think they do it.
Let's talk climate. What brought that to your agenda, to your awareness?
Well, the first 6 years in Congress, I said it was nonsense, Al Gore's imagination. Then I was out of Congress 6 years, doing commercial real estate law again in Greenville, South Carolina. Ran again in 2004. My son came to me. He was voting for the first time in 2004. He just turned 18. And he said, Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment. It's the first of three steps in my metamorphosis. Second step was going to Antarctica with the science committee, seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings.
So when you're saying seeing the evidence in the ice core drillings, meaning what?
Well, the South Pole, you know, is a mile of ice on top of a mile of dirt, so it's 10,000 feet above sea level. It's a desert. They get a quarter of an inch of precipitation a year. And so in the mile of ice, we have an amazing record of the Earth's atmosphere and CO2 levels. So we drill down through that mile of ice, we pull up the ice core, and then we go examine it and see the levels of CO2. And what it shows is stability followed by an uptick coinciding with the Industrial Revolution. And so it's pretty clear that that's the point at which we started burning fossil fuels, things that had been gone a long time, introducing them, pulling them up, burning them, changing the chemistry of the air, which affects the way that light enters, but all the radiant heat doesn't escape, and we get warming. That's the short story of climate change.
All right, I interrupted you. You said it was the second in three steps.
Yeah, and then the third step is really something of a spiritual awakening for me. Another science committee trip, Great Barrier Reef, snorkeling with an Aussie climate scientist who I could tell shared a worldview with me, that he was worshiping God even as he saw the creation. He wasn't worshiping the creation. So like St. Francis of Assisi said, you know, preach the gospel at all times, if necessary, use words. Scott was preaching the gospel just in his voice and his eyes and the way that he was interacting with nature. Later we had a chance to talk. He told me about conservation changes he was making in his life in order to love God and love people. Things like he rides his bike to work, he walks stairs, he doesn't take elevators. It means all kinds of things that some people might scoff at, saying those are little teeny things, but he does it very consciously in order to think about the people who come after us. People will never know. And so I found that real inspiring. So I came home and introduced the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. Probably not a good idea to introduce a carbon tax, even though it's revenue neutral, in the midst of the Great Recession. It didn't go well for me in the reddest district, in the reddest state in the nation.
I just want to go back to the coral reef for a minute. What was your reaction?
Well, first of all, the science that I've seen was that there's a relationship between the algae and the coral, and that's ending, and the result is the coral is dying. But the thing that I mostly saw was somebody who was acting on his faith in order to love God and love people, and completely, you know, proving for me at least, and I hope for others, that it's not that these godless scientists are trying to foist something on us with this climate change thing. You know, even today I heard somebody say it's a UN plot, you know, and essentially these godless scientists. Well, it's not. It's people like my wonderful friend, the Aussie climate scientist Scott Herron, who's doing his best to figure out the mechanisms at work here so that we can be good stewards of God's creation.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with former Congressman Bob Inglis, who currently directs the Energy and Enterprise Institute at George Mason University. Now, you said you announced a proposed carbon tax in June of 2009. You're a congressman, so when's your next election?
The primary was in June of 10, and the general election was in November of 10.
Okay, what happened?
Well, it wasn't even close in the primary. I got only 29% of the vote in a Republican runoff in June of 2010, losing to Trey Gowdy, a guy that's, of course, been the chairman of the Benghazi Committee.
And was the climate proposal on the carbon tax an issue in the campaign?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I committed other heresies as well. I voted for TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, you know, saving the banks. I was for comprehensive immigration reform, although we never called it that. That'd be the kiss of death. And I voted against a troop surge in Iraq. I had conservative concerns that George Bush was doing nation building in Iraq. But my most enduring heresy was just saying that climate change is real and let's do something about it.
Let me ask you about that, because that's still part of the public discourse, part of the public belief system. What's your explanation for why that view is so tenacious? As far as I can tell, unique to a part of the political spectrum in the United States. What's going on as you see it?
Well, you're right. I think it is unique to the United States. There's no other country that has quite like what we have here. And so I've got literally a baker's dozen reasons why conservatives have generally rejected action on climate. I won't give you all of them, but I'd give you a top line, I think, would be one that says we haven't liked the solution yet. What we've seen is solutions that increase the size of government, that increase the power of the nanny state. And so it's natural that conservatives thus far have rejected action on climate.
Let me just jump in. That suggests, if that analysis is correct, that these individuals accept the reality that emissions are causing climate change, but they're denying it because they don't like solutions that are being proposed. What they're saying is, many that I watch in the media, that it's a hoax, it's not proven, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm tempted to say what you're describing strikes me as dishonest. In other words, they're not saying it's a problem, we don't like the solutions. Am I missing something?
Yeah, I think it's a little more complex than that. It's basically that because there isn't a solution that seems palatable, we go back and doubt the existence of the problem. And that may sound strange, like, why would anybody do that? But if I tell you, here, Brian, here's a plan of surgery for that back problem you're having. First, we remove your head. After we've got your head off, we work on your spine, put your head back on. Thanks, doc. I'm feeling a lot better. I don't think I've got a back problem anymore, right? That's where conservatives are on climate, is they've heard about cap and trade. Cap means that we're going to regulate something. Trading means we're going to open up some kind of Wall Street scheme where some people do very well and probably the well-connected to some committee chairman. And so the result is that we think, we don't want this. This is anathema. And so we go back and doubt the existence of the problem. So what we have to show at republicen.org.
Republicen.org. Help me understand.
That's our web presence is something called republicen.org. It's republican.org. And so our concept is to develop a community of conservatives who will voice support for action from the right on climate change.
Let me ask you it another way. Let's say I am a fervent believer in free markets and think government intrusion is a fundamental problem.
Right.
And I would say that's a generally held conservative viewpoint.
Right.
Climate change is a result of, if it in fact is caused by emissions, unregulated private enterprise. Fair?
Correct, yes.
So in one sense, the existence of the problem, if I'm a pro-market conservative, is a challenge to my basic philosophy, and therefore maybe I have an emotional reaction to it. Is that fair or not fair?
Yes, I think that it's a failure of the application of that philosophy. So you can handle this really by the law of trespass. You know, if I'm Inglis Industries, and I'm making electricity, let's say, from things that produce emissions, I'm trespassing on my neighbor's property. I'm socializing my soot. I'm getting away with it. That is a trespass. And one way to deal with this problem is to deal with it in trespass law.
Common law, the old-fashioned common law.
And right.
Conservatives tend to argue, including some organizations in Montana, that those are more effective remedies than regulation.
Yeah, and there's a good philosophical case to be made for that. It's also true that administratively it's somewhat difficult to handle English industry's emissions that way. I mean, if I'm dumping on you, it's a little bit hard for you to have to run to the court every time I've made another dump. And so
it's also maybe hard for me to hire a lawyer if I don't have a lot of money and I'm up against a big economic interest.
Correct. And so that's why really it makes some sense, therefore, to set up a system where I, English Industries, am paying as I go for the harm that I'm causing. And if I do that and it's then put in the price of my product, there are other people in the marketplace that will compete against me and win.
Okay, let's talk about that specifically in relation to carbon, paying for the harm that you're doing. So you just said something pretty close to that. Mm-hmm. Tell me what your proposal is.
We support this idea of bringing all the cost to bear on all the fuels and eliminating all the subsidies. So no more subsidies for any fuels.
Give me an example or two of existing subsidies for fuel.
Solyndra direct subsidy of a company. Electric car credits, $7,500 credit for buying an electric car. Production tax credit for wind. All those kind of things are subsidies.
Those are all subsidies aimed at non-carbon energy.
Correct. Okay. They support and prop up renewables. Which we're all for renewables, but we think they should compete on their own merits. The biggest subsidy of them all, though, the one that we're in a building here, Coach, trying to persuade fellow conservatives of, is that the biggest subsidy of them all is being able to belch and burn into the trash dump of the sky without paying a tipping fee for using the dump. And so what we've got to show fellow conservatives is that's the biggest subsidy.
Let me see if I rephrase this and get it right. What you're proposing is you're saying dumping carbon into the air has a social cost, and the people doing the dumping should pay for that cost.
Correct.
Now, what's the consequence of it? I might say, fine, I can pay the cost, and I'm going to continue dumping carbon in the air. It's not going to hurt me. How do you think this is going to work in the real world? If carbon is causing the problem, what makes you think charging a tax on dumping carbon is going to solve the problem?
Well, it'll make it so that your product that you're selling in the free enterprise system costs more than your competitors who have a new technology that doesn't emit. And so the result is that I and many other enlightened consumers in the liberty of enlightened self-interest will buy those new products and leave you the old incumbent fuel by the wayside.
All right. Now, the difference between the subsidy of solar, let's say, and the imposing of the cost on carbon seems to me trying to achieve the same goal, shifting away from carbon-polluting fuels, by different means, fair?
Yes.
Why is one better than the other?
Because it's our approach, I would say, is more direct and simple. It's basically just calling accountability and the or bringing accountability. The problem with the other approach is that it ends up with the need to renew those credits. And then so solar and wind, for example, have a near-death experience every couple of years where they need the extension. If we could just say, listen, government's only role here is just be the honest cop on the beat that says all cost in, all subsidies removed. Now you all compete fairly.
Okay, I understand the principle. What's the specifics of the proposal you have on the table?
The bill that I had that we would support and some other possibilities too, but the bill that I had was a $15 per ton price on carbon dioxide rising to $100 a ton over 30 years' time. And it would have been offset by a dollar-for-dollar cut in payroll taxes. So there's no growth of government. It also would have been imposed on imports from countries that don't have a similar tax. That would make it so that if successful in through the World Trade Organization, it would be challenged. But if we were successful there, then we believe that other countries would impose the same price on carbon dioxide.
I don't know what burning a ton of coal produces in terms of CO2, but I remember it being quite surprised that as high as it was is something about atoms grouping up and making CO2.
Yeah.
So it's a high percentage. That aside, why the graduated rate from 15 to 100 over 30 years? We've got if you believe we have a problem now, and if you believe what the climate scientists like your friend are saying, we don't have 30 years to screw around. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I would be open to accelerating the pace as long as there's a corresponding tax cut. I'm ready to go higher or faster. The one thing about going too far too fast is innovation may not be able to keep up if you go dramatically fast. So probably better to have some sort of period of adoption of new technology where the price is rising steadily and perceptibly, but not dramatically.
New technology as in what?
Well, whatever the free enterprise system chooses by consumers choosing in freedom wherever they live. In some places it'll be wind, others solar, other places will be nuclear, other hydro. It just depends on where you live.
If I understand you correctly, you're saying there's an offset for any tax on carbon. There's a other tax reduction. So you said the net revenue to government doesn't change.
Correct, yeah.
And the purpose of that is to please conservatives who are concerned about the size and reach of government?
Correct. We don't want to grow the government. We want to make it so that we're dealing with the problem of climate change, but we're not growing government.
From reading the materials provided to me, you've been pitching this idea for 5 years. What kind of reception are you getting?
Things are coming along. We're making some progress. You know, when I lost in 10, you had to be completely atheistic about climate change. You had to say, I don't believe, and you shouldn't either. In the 2014 cycle, it became, I'm not a scientist. That's an agnostic position, which is a whole lot better from my perspective than the previous atheist position. Now, people like Senator John Cornyn of Texas are saying innovation is the key, which we at RepublicEN.org celebrate and say, you're right, Senator. Now, how do we get that innovation? And we think we get the innovation by fixing the economics, and then the environmental consequences will be corrected.
You're confident in your arguments, and you're obviously committed to this position. You're also an experienced politician. Give me your prediction for how long it's going to take to make this proposal work in a bipartisan way that actually becomes public policy in the United States of America.
I think it's probably 2022 is what we're thinking. It's a while. It takes a while to build the public will and the support for this. And so what we've got to do is build it on both sides of the aisle. This cannot be done just on the left. We have to pick people on the right who passionately believe this. And we think we can be successful because it's consistent with the deeply held views of conservatives and also fits with the views of progressives, that we really can bring America together on this.
Bob Inglis, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be with you.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.